wild episode in store for you. Glue yourself to your chair. I'm going to wait a minute. Are you glued in? Okay, let's get started. Mistweeted on the McFuture podcast starts right now. All right, let's talk innovation, tech, and futurism. I'm going to have to come up with a snappier title for this segment, but for now, this will do. First of all, this was mind-blowing. I don't know if you know who Jill Lepore is, but she's written for The New Yorker and a bunch of other places. She's written a lot of books. In fact, she's the one who went against Clayton Christensen and debunked Innovator's Dilemma. Since then, Clayton Christensen has passed away, and I blame Jill. Let's be honest. She probably killed him with her critique. No, I'm kidding. She's a wonderful lady, and I'm sure she meant well. Her new book explores this crazy real-life plot from the late 50s to create something called the People Machine. And the goal of this thing was to first understand, then predict, and then control human behavior. Now, it was done with the worst technology. The computers in the 50s had less power than a Bluetooth headset. They had less computing power than a calculator. So it was insane for them to think that they could do it, but it was so ambitious. And what's funny is that is the exact plot of this season's Westworld. So if you get a chance, check this out. She's been doing a lot of talks out there. And please don't bring up the Clayton Christensen thing. That was a bad, bad joke. And I'm a bad, bad person. Bad, bad. Okay, sorry. That was weird. There is a Twitter account called VC Brags, which makes fun of venture capitalists who are constantly bragging about their investments. Oh, I was the first investor in Patreon, or I was the first one to invest in Uber. I was in the second round of this company or that company. Anyway, there's a lot of bragging. Some of it is humble bragging, but mostly bragging. And I was looking through the timeline of this account, you know, where they repost all of these tweets, and it was depressing. Depressing in the sense that I've worked with a lot of finance people, and you know, basically that's what VCs are. They're people who give out money to startups. And there is so much bragging. There's zero humility. There's zero self-deprecation. Not much humor. I think they think they're funny, like frat guys think they're funny, but they're not. But there's also a West Coast flavor of finance guys. And VC guys from there are different because they're finance guys who are desperate to be seen as creative and visionary. So anything that puts a dent in that is seen as an existential threat, which is why all of these guys block the account. So the account reposts all of the VCs that have been blocking it. There's a couple that have a sense of humor, but the vast majority don't. Because listen, when your whole identity is wrapped up in your bank account and the number of unicorns you have, even the slightest dent is something you can't afford, is something your ego can't take. And it's so funny that this stupid Twitter account has that much power over these people. They're like, oh, I better block it. Laugh about it. It's really not that bad. And you know, it's so weird to be this humorless. And this is an example of something that's posted in the account. This is a guy I follow. I mean, he's a very smart guy. I still don't know his last name. It's Sahil is his first name. I'm sure he invented some startup that we all use. He wrote, everyone should angel invest. Everyone should angel invest. Now, angel investing typically involves investing in lots of companies at a minimum of $10,000, but realistically, it could be $100,000, could be two, could be $300,000. This woman reposted the tweet with a photo of people drowning in rent and student loan and debt and all kinds of problems, and their hand is sticking up out of the water, and and this guy comes in and high fives it, goes, hey, you should angel Angel Invest. I mean, the detachment. And look, he's probably speaking to a very different kind of audience, but even then, that audience can't be more than 100 or 200 people. So really, you know, some thoughts need to stay inside your head, even if you feel that way. Now, if there was a degree of humor or at least recognition in the tweet saying, hey, you know, if you ever get to this position, here are the benefits of angel investing. That's great. I'm sure there are lots of benefits. Number one benefit is having $100,000 burning a hole in your pocket that you can invest. Anyway, there's a disconnect. And this is what happens. People end up in bubbles. They have no idea how other people feel. And then you just put out stuff like this. And that doesn't make him a bad guy, but it also shows that he's not really thinking about the difference between the life he leads and the life other people who might be reading it are living. The other thing I'm seeing a lot of, VCs congratulating themselves on being woke. All of a sudden, they're starting funds for women and minorities and all these oppressed groups, and they are congratulating themselves. It is amazing. It is a festivus out there. They didn't suddenly just get woke. The reality is, they're out of hockey stick startups, ones that grow from like zero to thousands or hundreds of thousands of users in a few months. That's very rare. And we're out of them. There's way more money than there are great ideas to invest in. So essentially, these guys have to go deeper. They have to look at groups they haven't looked at before. They have to look at company types of companies that maybe they wouldn't have considered before, that maybe don't give them, you know, 1,000x return, but maybe give them, you know, 50 or 100x. Because of our insane society where we're patting everybody in on the back for nothing, they're getting caring points for doing what they would have done anyway. I go into a lot of this much deeper in an episode called World Without Billionaires. You should check it out. It's on the podcast. It's audio only, but you'll love it. Check it out. It's one of my favorites. I actually re-listen to my own episodes. Talk about narcissism. In 10 years or 20 years, will every school reunion just be screenshots? Hey, remember when Timmy and I were on this one screen, but then Sally was there and she was on this other screen, and they'll just be sharing screenshots with each other. We are robbing kids of their childhoods. This is insanity. Zoom has become a childhood, and it isn't. Not a good one. So we better get off this technological thing. And even for work, it's going to have to end soon because people are going insane in their houses. They need human interaction. They need human contact. They need to be something. They need to have some variability in their lives, something dangerous that might happen on the way, anything to make them feel alive. Especially children. All right. This guy, Adam Shapiro, posted, if universities could name Zoom breakout rooms after donors, the academic funding crisis could be solved. And I would take it a step further. I said they should have holograms of their donors moderating the calls. It's sort of like a Star Wars sequel where all the actors are now dead, but they're just CGI-ing them into the movies. So I think they should do that with all the donors. So imagine now you have all these universities that have gone virtual. Why not put the guy whose name is on the building into the virtual calls? He'll be like the new Clippy from Microsoft. Remember Clippy? I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but it was like this animated character that no one knew how to get rid of that was supposed to help you, but all it did was take up screen space. But now you'll have like a Clippy version of like the Tisch family who donated all these buildings at NYU. I think it'll be fun for the whole family and certainly for rich families. And really, what's more important than that, than helping rich families? If you can, go out there and help a rich family right now. Make them virtual. If you're a coder, go out there and do that for free because it's important. We need the Tisch family animated. Do them in different styles, like the, you know, Simpsons style and, you know, in South Park style. In 2009, man, 2009 was a big year for me. I have a lot of great historical tweets. In 2009, I wrote, I wonder if Google uses competitive data gathered from Gmail accounts of competitors or others in industries they're targeting. My vote, yes. So that's what I tweeted on July 14, 2009. So I decided to put that to the test. I threw it out there as a survey that got 122 votes. And this was the question I asked. You apply for a job at Google. Do you believe Google uses your collected data from any of their products, Maps or Chrome or whatever, to background check, aside from what is already publicly available? 74.6% said yes, 10.7% said no, and 14.8% said maybe. So less than 11% think that Google would not do this. This is a trust problem. And if Google doesn't see it as a trust problem, they really should. This is real. And when you have this much power and you're the goalkeeper between people and their connections on Gmail or any of the information they need, that's a serious obligation. And honestly, you know, I don't trust government to regulate it properly, but someone has to do something. And I would suggest that it be Google, because almost 90% of people think you're likely to use that data. And of course, forgetting that I had done that, I put out a second survey that was almost identical, where I said, Joe Rogan's contract expires in 4 years. I don't even know if it expires in 4 years, but it's a hypothetical. Joe starts negotiating with Google for a $500 million deal. Joe uses Gmail and Google apps for all communications and file storage. Do you think Google would access his info to gain advantage in negotiations? 85% of people are basically saying, hey, you're going to do this. And whether they do it or not is almost irrelevant, because having that kind of power is unprecedented, to say the least, but has to carry a responsibility of transparency and trust that obviously they have not achieved. And I satirized, that is the weirdest way to say that. I satirized this whole thing in an article I wrote, I think it was in Forbes. I wrote, why I should be Google's next CEO. And it's funny how life imitates art, because I basically predicted all these services like blackmail, competitor data mining, location-based snitching, NSA espionage, and all these other great dark fantasies that a lot of people are actually believing are possible. I wrote it sarcastically or satirically. If you read it now, it's not so satirical, because a lot of these things people either believe are true or Google may be accused of. In fact, I just heard that the Department of Justice is investigating Google for anti-competitive practices. Look, this is not going to stop. When you have companies that control this much data and have this much power over our minds, really, scrutiny is inevitable. And Google's doing something else, which is they are creating specific identifiers based on who you are and your latitude and longitude. This is part of a pattern that I've noticed. They're trying to make location proprietary. I first noticed this when I started using Google Maps, and I saw that they were excluding building numbers from their location. So when you would enter it in, it would just show you the street, but it wouldn't really show you the full address. That's a way of subtly creating dependency, because if you don't know the street address, you can't, you know, it doesn't give you as many options to look it up elsewhere or to just go building by building and find the place. So you're fully reliant on their app to help you locate things. And now they're basically creating these short addresses, which is a logical extension of that, where it's tying you into dependence on them to find your way. It's really brilliant, innovative, and super devious, and I thought you should know. And I've been experimenting with OpenStreetMaps, which really don't have the polish or the information that Google Maps do, but I'm determined to try not to die in my car using their service. So I will experiment a little bit further or steadily on routes that I know and see what happens. You know, I was watching Whitney Cummings' podcast, and she was talking to this guy, Lex Friedman. He works on self-driving cars. And it occurred to me that we're not that far off from a purely digital celebrity. Once we're consuming all of our content digitally on this little device, it's not that hard to create an attractive personality, an attractive person who says a lot of the things that we enjoy hearing, because a company like YouTube or Spotify certainly knows what our preferences are. And with this combination of AI and algorithms and digital design and deep fakes, we can have a personalized experience with a celebrity that we adore who's not even real. And it's the same thing I wrote about in 2015, which is, I think it was a piece called The Next Disruption of Music. Because you can break down to the second or millisecond where people tune out of a song. You can piece together, based on that data, entirely original music based on what a person enjoys listening to. And you can probably at some point do that with podcasters or celebrities. So you won't need me. They'll just be some avatar. Hopefully I get the Patreon money still. Patreon.com/McFuture. I saw a review for a giant monitor. At some point, you don't own the monitor. The monitor owns you. It is gigantic. Kind of reminds me of, I remember when I was a young bachelor, a friend of mine came over my apartment and he looked at my TV, which I wasn't even using at the time. And he just swipes his finger across and all this dust falls off and he just leaves a finger streak in it. And he says, "Hey, there's some TV on your dust." It just cracked me up. We are being subsumed into the matrix. And at some point, the final evolution of TV will be watching another person on Netflix watching Netflix. You know how kids are watching other kids playing games? I say kids. There's probably a 45-year-old guy who's doing it right now somewhere. I can envision that type of voyeurism because we're getting more narcissistic and more bored. This might be some other way to create sort of a life within a life. I was looking for a replacement battery online, and there was a company, I swear to you, was called Pure Dick. Pure Dick. It's spelled exactly like it sounds. And that was a 4.5-star rated battery. I was also looking for USB hubs. And these were the brands I found. Falwetti, Powlakin, Asdome. Their branding agency, look, I'm not a big fan of the death penalty, but I think they should be executed. And these are all Chinese companies, clearly. They're not even trying. And China's not above executing people. Put them in a camp somewhere, re-educate them with marketing, and let them come back and just give them cool names like iPhone or, I don't know, what's a cool name? Nintendo PlayStation. And by the way, Elon Musk's baby is running their branding agency. Her name is XAEA-12 or something like that. She's a lovely girl. She's going to grow up perfectly normal, and her homeroom teacher is not going to be pissed at all. As you might know, I have a long and illustrious history in corporate America. So I have many, many feelings, sometimes very emotional ones, and sometimes very judgmental ones, and sometimes hilarious ones about that experience. So I introduce you to a new section called You've Lost That Corporate Feeling. And let's jump into all things corporate. There was a study that turns out to be false. They tried to replicate it and they couldn't. It was a study about the bystander effect, where if, you know, someone needs help, because there are all these people around, no one feels a sense of obligation to help out. And, you know, the person just bleeds out. They just lay there and it's all over. It turns out that people are much more likely to help than they realized. This was always a flawed study. The inaction of others is rare in those personal circumstances, but is very powerful inside of corporations. And that is because of something I call the diffusion of responsibility. I don't know if I came up with it or other people have described it this way. When an organization is so big, there's so many divisions, there's so many hierarchies, there's so much self-interest, and there's such a slow pace of change that it absolves people of the responsibility of doing the right thing. You can act amorally or sometimes immorally to get ahead or to please your boss because that's what you think will be necessary to advance yourself or to keep your job. So you're okay doing sketchy things, maybe approving a drug that shouldn't have been approved or fudging something that shouldn't have been fudged or getting people addicted to technology that probably isn't good for them. Those are all things you're willing to do because as organizations get larger, there are more and more people in control. And so each individual inside shares a smaller and smaller percentage of power and also accountability. The CEO should feel the weight of that accountability, but they're not privy to all the little tiny decisions that are being made throughout the corporations that could add up to a whole lot. I've seen cover-ups of all kinds of really bad corporate behavior, letting things slide that probably shouldn't have slid. If they were done during the era of Me Too, there would have been heads rolling out those doors. So the CEO of Coinbase, which is a digital wallet for these alternative currencies like Bitcoin, he wrote a letter basically saying to his employees that we're going to have an apolitical culture. We're not going to discuss politics in the office, which has been the trend and quite honestly, a very destructive one inside of corporations because people who think they have the right to speak or are being encouraged to speak, the minute they say something that makes their company look bad or attracts bad media attention or pisses off other employees, their heads roll. Look, no company really wants you to speak out politically. That's the truth, because politics are very toxic. And whenever you introduce this toxicity into an organization, it can eat it alive because not everyone agrees with your politics. Clearly, you see what's going on. Not every culture is a monoculture. There's something to be said for what he did. And here's what I have to say about it. I don't think corporations are great vessels for morality. And I've made that case in previous episodes. With him declaring no politics or activism at work, but we're not going to fire you or judge you for all the things you do outside of work, is a perfectly fair statement. What I like about it is it clearly defines what the culture is and is not, right? It's all about business. It's all about helping our customers, but it's not about politics. The second thing is he offered the people who don't agree with that philosophy an exit package. And I think 60 of their employees took him up on it, which makes sense because those are people, hey, this is not for you. And they're very employable, I'm sure. This is a very tech-savvy environment. I'm sure those people are really employable. Plus, they get a nice cushion to go look for another job. But there is a missed opportunity here. The company should engage on issues that directly impact the business. Now, you could make a bunch of circular cases for why all these other things do impact the business, but they should create a culture where the employee should argue why they think a particular issue impacts the company and the company should act on it, but it should be integrated with the business. And by not stating that, and you can look up his statement, but by not stating that, I think he's leaving something important on the table because it shouldn't be all or nothing. It should be where we have something of value to offer and where there is something or a problem we can solve or people we can help directly with our product, not indirectly with our profits, because those are things that can be done outside of work, then maybe we should discuss it. So anyway, I think it's a little bit more nuanced, but I also think there's value in that clarity of what you are and what you're not and defining your culture. I see these headlines every once in a while from Inc. and Entrepreneur. They're basically just listicles. 5 ways Steve Jobs became a great leader. three things that Elon Musk would never do in an office environment. None of these authors know Steve Jobs. None of these people, there's no one to know at this point, but none of them know Elon Musk. None of them have any insight into their minds. They're just pumping out low-grade content. And it's sort of like entrepreneurship as seen through the eyes of a child with learning disabilities. You can simplify almost anything into uselessness. And these articles are so dumb, so dumbed down. They are beyond useless. It is a wasteland, unfortunately. Which is one of the reasons I don't write for a lot of these places anymore. But in case they want to pay me a lot of money, they can put this brilliant content on there. I saw someone post that they had a new job, and this was the description. Quote, his team will be focused on connecting the Post's suite of storytelling and tech-led solutions to build programs and experiences for brands. You know, sometimes I really do miss corporate speak. And sometimes I think about putting out a rap album. I can't believe people speak this way. It's mind-blowing to me. Mind-blowing. You have to speak English. This is not English. This is something else. And chances are these jobs aren't that useful or too convoluted to be successful. I'm actually thinking of starting a company called Acronymph, which basically launches new services based on the latest acronym or catchphrase. So some of the past and present hits are things like Y2K, SEO, CRM, SaaS, SMART, Disruption, Omnichannel, Big Data, Hyperlocal, Growth Hacking, ESG. I don't even know what that one. Oh, I know what that is. That's the socially conscious investing. D&I, which is diversity and inclusion. WFH, work from home. I mean, we're going from Y2K, which was the apocalypse, to work from home. It's like, don't even come in. So I think you could build a service around that. Mostly it's pillows. It's a pillow company. Do you have some favorites of your own? Let me know. I just imagine this dialogue in my head. Hey, what did you do at Oracle? I disrupted them. Did it work? I think so. I was fired. Congrats. High five. You know, it's like corporate disruptor is the new unemployed. Yeah, some of these words, disruption is especially a douchey one, because if you're working for a corporation, you're not really taking that much of a risk, you're leaving at a decent hour, you've got a 401k plan, and all of your stuff has to be approved by five layers of management, how much are you disrupting, realistically? Tell me. But listen, people need their monikers, they need their badges, and they need their sanity. So a lot of times it's just a way to feel better about how they spend their day, which is fine. I'm all for it as therapy. Spotify introduces polls, basically an interactive tool to take surveys of your audience. Remember podcasts, the thing that you used to enjoy? Now it's a test. Now you can't just listen anymore. You've got homework and you've got all this data collection and marketing that they want to do. This is the path of all things that succeed. Nothing successful can ever stay pristine. You know, there are always people who arrive early and start listening to a band. Like I remember when Metallica put out their Black album, everyone was like, oh, they totally sold out. Because people actually bought the album and they made songs that are less than 9 minutes. And people were like, oh no, they're totally selling out. And I'm like, yeah, it's called having fans. You discover them. Why can't other people? Same with festivals, like South by Southwest was like this, you know, cool hipster kind of thing. There was another one in New York. I forget what it was called. But, you know, people like to know these cool little things. And then guess what? It becomes successful because it's good. And then all the money comes in. It acts like a magnet for, you know, advertisers and promoters and self-promoters and influencers and name brand speakers. And once that money comes in, it's never going to be the same. It's very hard to keep things pristine because money's being thrown at the creators of these things. And they want to expand. And the natural thing is to expand. But eventually they get too big and they collapse under their own weight, which incidentally is the innovator's dilemma, because as corporations take on all this bloat, it opens the door for small competitors to come in and provide that original flavor or that narrow solution that people want without trying to be all things to all people or this gigantic thing. But that is the path of all things. Very few can say, hey, we're going to stay artisanal forever. Even Ben and Jerry's, the biggest hippies on earth, those guys, you know, are in every supermarket. They've got retail locations. They've got all kinds of stuff going on. And then they sold out to, you know, a big corporation that bought them up. So it's the way of all things. Even hippies cannot stay innocent in this world. That is capitalism. And we cannot deny its power. We can't. That is how we all operate. Even the lovable, huggable, furry Ben and Jerry. Are they technically considered furries? I wonder. Anyway, I wrote, everything will be a subscription. Soon there will only be one form of ownership of you by them. Them being the company selling you those subscriptions. And right now, that is the holy grail of capitalism, to get everyone to rent their lives from companies forever. And there are some serious implications for the future about this. I'm going to do a whole episode on this, but I'm just teeing it up now. Realistically, the only good subscription that I can think of is my podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/McFuture. And I suggest you go out there and do it. Seriously. I mean, just because I have a half smile on my face, it doesn't mean I don't need the money. I need the money. Just go ahead and do it. This is a mantra that's been going around corporate, especially. Bring your true self to work. Or sometimes it's bring your whole self to work. Yeah, if you want to get fired, bring your employable self to work. Bring the guy or girl who is going to keep the job to work. Save the remainder for your friends and family and other people who can tolerate it. However, there is a caveat there. The more true our employable self is to our real self, the more satisfying the job will be. So that is true, but that doesn't give you license to bring your whole self. You can maybe bring maybe 1/8 to 1/5 of you. The rest has to stay home. It has to be chained up in the basement with all of your whips and chains and rubber implements, because that is your whole self. That has to stay home. This personality, I only allow 7% of it into the office until I know people can, you know, inch upwards towards, you know, 14, 15, 16%. But you have to have an accurate assessment of who you are and what you bring. And there's a lot of you, whatever you are, that is not employable and should stay home and stay private. Unfortunately, there aren't enough jobs for everyone to be their true self. And it's really kind of an elitist thing if you think about it, because we all want our Amazon deliveries. We all want our houses cleaned. We all want all of these services. We all want our vegetables sold to us. We all want, you know, the cashier to check us out. We all want these things, and we want those people to do it, those people. But we have to be fulfilled. We got to be ourselves. We got to bring our whole selves to work. Does the Amazon delivery guy, does he get to bring his whole self to work? Does the Target cashier, does she get to bring her whole self to work? So really, this is a selfish, blowhardy thing. And realize when you say it, what you're doing. You're really kind of blowing a lot of elitist smoke. So stop. And the other one that's going around is, you never need to return to the office. Yeah, unless you want the FaceTime needed to network and bond with people who can actually promote you. Look, this is not a permanent state, because at some point you're going to need to build real relationships. You cannot build it over Zoom. Yes, there have been people who have had successful, you know, sort of first dates through, you know, Zoom or phone calls back in the day, but that is not the norm. The longer you do that, the emptier it's going to feel. people need to be in the same room. They need to have that, you know, physicality to their exchanges. And so much is spoken in body language. And video helps, but it's not the whole thing. You don't know if someone's like shaking their legs or has like irritable leg syndrome or something like that. But regardless, we are creatures that need connection. We are animals. We are filthy animals. And I know we like to think we're erudite. That's a big ass word. We like to think of ourselves as, oh, you know, I'm above it. I've taken all of those low level sort of emotions out of my life. I'm this evolved person. Bullshit. That is not true. We are still animals under all of this. And there's some guy who just got caught jacking off. I guess he works for the New Yorker or something, Jeffrey Toobin. So this guy, you know, talk about animalistic. The guy couldn't wait till the end of his Zoom call to start jacking off. And look, you know, I don't think he should be fired for it, but I think he should definitely be skewered for it. It's absolutely necessary. But the reality is we cannot allow people to sit around in their underwear indefinitely instead of going into some office. Not all the time, maybe. Maybe we have more of a balance, but certainly not forever like this. What stops 86% of remote professionals from wearing underwear all day? No pockets. Underwear needs pockets. Where is the great inventor or seamstress or seamster? Seamster sounds like a failed startup from the 2000s, whatever the male version of it is. But where is the tailor? Is that the, why is it seamstress and tailor? Shouldn't it be tailor and tailress or seamstress and seamster? Anyway, some linguists get in touch with me. Underwear with pockets is a huge win. Now, I think you're going to need a stronger band because I think you're going to be having a lot of Jeffrey Toobin moments if you put too much in the pockets. Has there ever been a time in history where so many exclusives were so readily available to everybody? Think of all the things that are promoted as exclusive. All these products. Oh, you can never get this purse ever again. It is so precious. It is like gold. And there actually is a Birkin bag that's sort of like that. But most things are not that precious. Most things are not that exclusive. Most of us are drowning in products and services and content and podcasts and all kinds of stuff. So the exclusivity thing is almost comical at this point. It's very hard to claim exclusivity. There are a few things. Yes, maybe if you had an exclusive interview with Oprah. I keep bringing up Oprah because I want to be the white Oprah. And I think it's time. It's time to have a white male Oprah. It's about time we had some equality in this world. Sorry. Anyway, exclusives. Nah. And when exclusive brands become inclusive, who repairs the space-time continuum? Because now I'm having a little schizophrenia because everyone's like, oh, this is exclusive. This is exclusive. And then in the same breath, they're like, oh, we're totally inclusive. First of all, if you're an exclusive brand, by definition, you are not inclusive. If you're building your reputation on hot people wearing trendy clothes, you are not inclusive. You are not hiring everybody. Yeah, maybe tokenism, where you're like, oh, look at, we found a disabled model or something like that, where, you know, they get to congratulate themselves. But at the end of the day, they make their money on Instagram, on hot people. That is not inclusive. I doubt those two can ever align. By the way, I had the worst meal delivery experience with GitHub. Terrible. That was a developer joke. I want to take a moment to commemorate the loss of a good friend of mine, Sizzler. I know there have been a lot of chains of restaurants and retail chains that have gone out of business, but when I was growing up and as a poor immigrant, Sizzler and Beefsteak Charlie's were our family's fancy go-to restaurants. That $11.99 dinner special, I think it was the early dinner special, because I think if you showed up like after 6 o'clock, it jumped up to $15.99, and there's no way my dad was ever going to pay for that. Those were our fancy meals out, so I have fond memories. It wasn't the best food. As a kid, that unlimited salad bar was so amazing. I had never seen that much fresh food in my house ever. Our house, my mom would boil a chicken for like 6 hours until the chicken just like, look, I want to die. again. It's just, it was terrible. She was not a great cook and she was not really trying. But listen, I love her. She's a wonderful woman. Cooking, not her forte. But that salad bar, when I saw all that stuff, all the, even the vegetables, everything looked so amazing. And I would get 4 or 5 servings. Just the thought of it, it's almost ranking in my memory the same as when Phoebe Cates in Fast Times at Ridgemont High walked out of that pool and like every 13-year-old boy in the country immediately hit puberty. It's like, oh, I get it. Oh, I think I know what this is all about. It's sad to see Sizzler go. Not that I was a big patron recently, but it helped some good memories. And I was a poor immigrant. And I guess that also helps me appreciate the things I do have right now. Someone asked why the NBA takes all of these three-point shots. And I read that it was some sort of Moneyball type analysis that showed that even three-point shots from a lower percentage range are still better than two-pointers. As a fan, that's made basketball so boring to me. I played with a bunch of chubby white guys who could hit three-pointers all day long. And honestly, I think diversity looms for the NBA. I imagine a bunch of guys named Tony or Igor showing up into the NBA. Yeah, they're all going to be like 5'9", and they're just going to be burying threes all day. They can't really run up and down the court, but they'll park themselves and just start plopping threes down. And I miss the good old days. I remember Allen Iverson. The guy would just run into a bunch of giant defenders. The guy would get beaten up in the paint trying to score those shots. And there were a bunch of guys like that. I mean, Magic Johnson always drove to the hoop. Of course, Michael Jordan. All of these great players. But now it's rarer and rarer, and it's made the game less interesting. But it really goes to show you what happens to any business. It corporatizes. And you get a bunch of people who are analysts combing through the data, trying to understand what works and what doesn't work. And ultimately, they start making different decisions based on that data. But those decisions also have unintended consequences. For example, the NBA Finals had the lowest ratings in history. And I think some of it is related to COVID. Some of it might be related to politics. But that could also be a consequence of making the game more boring and a bunch of guys standing around and taking jump shots. So I think that they may find very soon that that was not a great decision and might go back on it. I talked about this in a previous episode, how we fail to see our weaknesses and our blind spots. Well, this week, I decided to do something different. I decided to post it as a survey question, and this is what I asked. If 4 separate groups of aliens had access to only 1 data set, which one would give them the most accurate view of our society today? So the choices were the Bible, stock market data, intersectionality and critical race theory and all this woke politics, or all the software that's been used since 1995. 62% voted for software, 24% voted for the Bible, intersectionality came in at 9.5%, and stock market data at 4.8%. So overwhelmingly, people think that the software we use says the most about us. Now, I could have a skewed population. Maybe I attract a lot of techies. The Bible came in second. And I think what's interesting is a lot of fiction that's been written since the Bible doesn't add anything new in terms of storylines. They're still about love, revenge, family, purpose, all of these things that we struggle with and maybe we reframe in modern terms, but they're still eternal struggles. And a lot of what's in there, whether you believe in religion or the Bible or Christianity or Judaism, whatever, the stories themselves are human stories. And it's interesting that the digital story which is software, won out over the biblical one. Anyway, what would you choose? I asked, what percentage of nonfiction books could have been tweets instead? And then I answered it, 70% of business books could probably have been tweets. What I find in business books is once they establish the premise and give you a couple of examples in the first chapter or two, the rest of it just repeats itself. It's really exhausting. I wouldn't wish most business books on anybody. You could argue that it's a private sector jobs program because no one's going to hire you to speak based on your tweets. So you have to produce something that looks like a product that you've put a lot of thought into, and there's your book. A lot of these concepts would have been better communicated as 15-minute animated YouTube videos rather than books. Unfortunately, those are harder to monetize, but I think they're much more effective at conveying concepts in a way that's memorable. If you look at the stats, a smaller and smaller percentage of people read, especially business books. And I speak from experience. A bestseller in business is not that much. All it takes is 10,000 books. 10,000 books. That's it. Your morning platitude can bolster your attitude, fortitude, and aptitude. Have you noticed a lot of people posting inspirational quotes? Are they looking to inspire you or themselves? I feel like people should stop because I find it a little bit sad. The inspirational quotes oftentimes are being put out there by people who aren't necessarily happy and are trying to make themselves happy by making other people happy with vapid platitudes. Vapitudes. Oh, I just invented a word. No one take that. Vapid platitudes. Although actually platitudes are already vapid. Anyway, forget I said everything. It's all meaningless. See you later. Thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, support the show. Go to patreon.com/McFuture and tell a friend, tell your enemies. And listen, the more people know about this, the more chances I have at rescuing the world from itself. Now, isn't that a noble cause? So go ahead, tell somebody, tell them now. Go ahead. When the aliens do come, I hope that I'm too old and chewy for them to bother with. If they found a way to make it here, we're going to be either food or pets, at best pets. Practice tricks, practice that, you know, like where you use your feet to roll the ball in the air. Practice doing that because when they come, be super entertaining.